Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 119, and they call it Democracy, Part 2. The show title is from Bruce Coburn's song, Call It Democracy, and again featuring a book by Sheldon S. Wolin. Sheldon S. Wolin is Professor Emeritus of Politics at Princeton University. His books include Politics and Vision and Tocqueville Between Two Worlds, both from Princeton. That's Tocqueville. Not a book about smoking weed. This book in the show is Democracy Incorporated. Sheldon S. Wolin, wonderful writer, and seems like a wonderful guy too. Just that short little bio, very humble bio on the back of the book. And the subtitle, Manage Democracy and the Specter of Inverted Totalitarianism. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Democracy, starting off the part two. I touched on it in the last show. Managed democracy is, this is Wolin's writing, managed democracy is centered on containing electoral politics. It is cool, even hostile, towards social democracy beyond promoting literacy, job training, and other essentials for a society struggling to survive in the global economy. Managed democracy is democracy systematized. And another description, a demotion in the status and stature of the sovereign people to patient subjects is symptomatic of systemic change from democracy as a method of popularizing power to democracy as a brand name for a product manageable at home and marketable abroad. That says a lot. Manageable at home and marketable abroad. because that is often the one of the lines, watch justifications by politicians on TV for going in war in other countries to, quote, spread democracy. Social democracy, at least the little that I'm familiar with the term, is actually happening in places like Venezuela. Another example, Wolin gives in the saga of the Florida recount, was a clear demonstration of managed democracy. Earlier, I referred to superpower as formless. That requires amending. Florida demonstrated that superpower indeed has a form, and moreover, revealed its lineaments. Unlike all traditional conceptions of a constitutional form where the political character was primary and defining, superpower represents a substantive transformation. A corporate or economic model of governance has been superimposed upon a political form whose constitution consisted partly of Republican anti-populist elements and partly of democratic elements. The Florida recount was as much an example of a corporate takeover as of a coup d'etat. In the new model, the presidency bears little resemblance to the original conception of a national leader and chief executive. It owes even less to the later ideal of the president as the tribune of the people. Instead, the office is modeled after the corporate CEO. The president is neither above politics nor is he a popular tribune, although if circumstances requires, he may momentarily assume those stances. Rather, his role in part to protect and advance the economic and ideological interests that form the dynamic of superpower. These will be discussed in another chapter, but the president is also what might be called a sine mythological figure, the embodiment of a popular myth constructed of Hollywood movies, the gentle patriarch Reagan, or the straight-shooting defender of order, George II. Underneath the myths, the president, like the CEO, is the dominant power in the organization. In contrast, Congress, which was once thought to be the predominant branch of government because it supposedly stood closer to the people, has been demoted to a position of power comparable to that of a corporate board. The latter tend to be creatures of the CEO rather than the independent supervisory power to which the CEO is theoretically responsible. Like a board, Congress may occasionally display independence, especially when it and the president represent opposing parties. But the main point is that Congress has lost its close connection with the citizenry. Poll after poll has shown that of all national political institutions, it ranks lowest in terms of public confidence. Finally, in the image of shareholders who wield small power over the CEOs or boards and are stirred to protest only when dividends disappoint, so the citizenry has embraced a diminished role. Like shareholders, they can vote out their own CEO, the president, or their board of directors, Congress, but mostly they want to be assured that the CEO president is, quote, heading the country in the right direction, end quote. And here's a bit of the revolving door complex. State power not only relies upon corporate power for the conversion of scientific advances into technological achievements, but depends heavily on corporate personnel for policy advice and managerial skills. Consider this postmodern potpourri. Politicians resign in order to accept lucrative corporate positions. Corporate executives take leave, typically with delayed compensation, to run government departments and set policies. And high-ranking military officers are hired by corporations, become TV commentators, join faculties, and run for presidential nominations. One consequence is that the political has been managerialized. Politics and elections, as well as the operation of governmental departments and agencies, now are routinely considered a managerial rather than a political skill. Management is not a neutral notion, however. Its roots are in the business culture, its values shaped by the pressures of a competitive economy that persistently push the limits of legality and ethical norms. The arrogance that leads corporate executives to violate the law finds its parallel in the arrogance with which superpower flouts or disregards international norms. And another section, which has another bit about managing democracy. The so-called free market is not simply about buyers and sellers or producers and owners, but about power relationships that are fundamental to the management of democracy. Financial markets are not just about securities, but about useful insecurities. These constitute methods of discipline, of reinforcing certain behaviors and discouraging others, of accustoming people to submitting to hierarchies of power, of exploiting the tentative nature of employment, the uncertainty of rewards, pension systems, and health benefits. The union of corporate and state power means that, instead of the illusion of a leaner system of governments, we have the reality of a more extensive, more invasive system than ever before, one removed from democratic influences and hence better able to manage democracy. Oh, there he refers to the Mussolini's fascist definition of corporate and state powers. So the union of corporate state power means that instead of the illusion of a leaner system of governance, we have the reality of a more extensive, more invasive system than ever before, one removed from democratic influences and hence better able to manage democracy. So reading these bits, get the more of the sense that the managed democracy is sort of the mechanism which helps to keep the, or bring about, or keep whatever the inverted totalitarianism. One thing that Wolin says is that, it mentions it a bunch of times in the book, the managed democracy is sort of rules over democratic influences, like he was just saying. Instead of actual democracy being encouraged, the managed democracy is sort of to maintain this facade of democracy, while not really doing it. This little section starts with a stunning quote by President George W. Bush. We support the election process, we support democracy, but that doesn't mean we have to support governments that get elected as a result of democracy. Today, references to corporate culture are commonplace. Corporate culture might be defined as the norms and practices operative at various levels of the corporate hierarchy that shape or influence the beliefs and behavior of those who work in a particular institutional context. Today, corporate culture is not confined to the corporation. Managed democracy depends upon managers, and managers are the product and creators of corporate culture. The question is this: what are the characteristics of the culture that corporate managers bring to government? How are the corporatists likely to approach power and governance? And how does that approach differ from political conceptions? A nice thing that Wolin does many times in the book is he just asks questions. And I found that refreshing. You know, for one, it's showing he doesn't have all the answers, and it makes the reader think. A managed democracy is the application of managerial skills to the basic democratic political institution of popular elections. An election, as distinguished from the simple act of voting, has been reshaped into a complex production. Like all productive operations, it is ongoing and requires continuous supervision rather than continuing popular participation. Supervision over participation. Unmanaged elections would epitomize contingency, the managerial nightmare of control freaks. One method of assuring control is to make electioneering continuous, year-round, saturated with party propaganda, punctuated with the wisdom of kept pundits, bringing a result boring rather than energizing, the kind of civic lassitude on which a managed democracy thrives. A large campaign contribution represents the kind of surplus power a dynamic capitalist economy makes available. It begins as the production of an ordinary commodity, say a computer chip, which eventually turns a profit that is then invested in a candidate or party or a lobbyist in order to purchase access to those who are authorized to make policies or decisions. A law or regulation favorable to the donor mysteriously emerges, an immaculate deception or earmark with no apparent father. No one wants to acknowledge paternity or reveal the consensual act that produced it. At issue is more than crude bribery. Campaign contributions are a vital tool of political management. They create a pecking order that calibrates in strictly quantitative and objective terms whose interests have priority. The amount of corruption that regularly takes place before elections means that corruption is not an anomaly but an essential element in the functioning of managed democracy. That's quite a statement. Corruption is part of it. The entrenched system of bribery and corruption involves no physical violence, no brown-shirted stormtroopers, no coercion of the political opposition. While the tactics are not those of the Nazis, the end result is the inverted equivalent. Opposition has not been liquidated, but rendered feckless. And he adds, managing democracy requires a process by which extreme views are filtered and control rests with a favored guardian group, the, quote, right people, end quote, who have been pre-selected by the conquerors and rewarded with being the first to gain a foothold in power. From that strategic vantage point and under the watchful supervision of the conquerors, they are expected to produce the political structures of a democracy in which power is distanced from the people in whose name it is to be exercised. So, yeah, it's like he's showing how it's a show. You know, it's basically a staged show. And another reference to the Nazis. The Nazis called it, I don't know how to pronounce it, but I'll try Gleichschaltung. Gleichschaltung, meaning coordination. We might call it, quote, management, end quote, to indicate its place in an opportunity society. And superpowers' mission of spreading democracy throughout the world would seem to fit into the tradition of American expansionism, the resumption of the Wilsonian crusade to make the world safe for democracy. But the unstated assumption behind that genealogy is that democracy has first to be made safe for the world. Managed democracy is that achievement, and it has precedence and antecedents. Interesting there, sort of this product, you know, this tested product. And he also refers in the book to something he calls fugitive democracy, which is maybe around the Shays Rebellion, I'm not sure. But he talks about the spontaneousness of, you know, small pockets of people as a form of fugitive democracy, actually people joining and actually getting something done. And I think at the end he cites that as actually one of the ways to actually improve things in the government, with the world, etc., in the U.S., is the fugitive democracy. See that? I guess that would be similar to the phrase the flash mob, or the way that the technology, the cell phones, have made it possible now for large masses of people to notify each other in a very short time and to mobilize. So that would be a modern form of the fugitive democracy. A longer section here. One shouldn't expect empire to promote liberty, participation, or equality other than as versions of economic opportunity. The object of its managed democracy is not to persuade the citizens, but, depending on the objective, to neutralize or incite them. Managed democracy is not the creature of a tyrannical majority as the founders feared. On the contrary, managed democracy thrives on active suppression, but on an electorate so evenly divided as to prevent the formation of a strong majority will. While an evenly divided electorate stymies the formation of effective majorities, it enhances the power of corporate lobbies, that is, of determined, single-minded, lavishly financed minority wills that operate independently of electoral results. Near deadlock diminishes the legislature's ability to exercise vigorous oversight of the executive and opens the way for an unprecedented assertion of executive power, especially if a legislature is riddled with corruption. Yet there are grounds for believing that while the American empire may persist, American hegemony is weakening. The debacle of Iraq, the mounting American casualties, pictures of soldiers without limbs, Iraqi casualties so numerous that the American military is loath to report them, the destruction of that society's entire economy, educational system, and culture have by this time begun to shame the American conscience. The huge cost of the war, the escalating share of the national budget claimed by defense spending, the spiraling national deficit, mounting foreign debts, looming oil shortages, a fitful economy, and a shredded social net suggest that the nation can no longer afford to subsidize grandiose imperial ambitions, that retrenchment of American power is necessary. From midsummer of 2005 to spring of 2007, public opinion surveys consistently indicated that a majority of Americans were losing confidence in the president and beginning to doubt the merits and public rationale for the invasion of Iraq. That finding is of a piece with a spate of articles, books, independently produced movies, and occasional TV shows critical of the mess in Iraq, and with the public criticism by retired generals of the administration's handling of the war. Even some conservative supporters began to question the administration's loose spending habits and appetite for foreign adventures. And then this next sentence, he very made me put the hmm on in the margin here.
The twilight of empire will not necessarily spell the demise of inverted totalitarianism. I think he's saying because the inverted totalitarianism is sort of so entrenched in the system, the culture, the capitalism, the democracy, that, you know, in some sense, whatever happens with empire is not necessarily connected to that. Then Wolin continues, the fact of terrorism combined with the imaginary it has assumed in the national consciousness will provide justification enough for retaining the security apparatus, subsidizing the defense industry, and nurturing the fear factor while accustoming the citizen to a legal regime that sanctions extra-constitutional powers, including the torture of prisoners and domestic spying. Nor is it likely that the Republican Party will abandon its goal of attaining a permanent majority, much less renounce the alliances it has cultivated with corporations, religious groups, conservative intellectuals, and powerful lobbies. And then another section, granted that the invasion of Iraq was politically immoral, duplicitous, and stupid, the blame game is at bottom an unwitting acknowledgement of the shallowness of the political culture of American democracy and of the persistence of anti-democratic tendencies. For the public disenchantment with the Iraq War unintentionally reveals how deeply leadership dependent the democracy has become. Fault is attributed exclusively to the White House, never to the citizenry for its unthinking support of the venture. If by luck the war had been won as quickly as the administration assumed, or purported to assume, would democracy have even blinked? Not only did the citizens endorse the president's war by re-electing him, in 2000 that same citizenry had watched supinely as the Bush team defied the electorate and achieved a political coup. Strong democracies, Weimar, referring to the Weimar Republic in Germany. That's pretty, he just hit so many things right on the head, and, you know, it's not just a blame game, and he shows how the, you know, the people, the level of apathy, which I think was also a common thread in Nazi Germany, but, you know, he touches on the way the whole rigmarole works, and you know, and he's empathetic with the whole thing about Iraq, so really sounding assessment of things. Sort of to wrap up this show, it's going to get into, Wolin goes into, it's a long section, so I just want to highlight it. Basically, he says, this was sort of very much news to me, throughout most of Western history, democracy, far from being the establishment, was virtually unknown, with the exception of ancient Athens, where democracy generally prevailed from roughly 450 to 322 B.C., no example of a democratic regime appeared during the subsequent 2,000 years. So that's pretty astounding. And he mentions demos. That's sort of the demos is the idea of politically engaged and empowered citizenry. And democracy, the root demokratia from Greek demos plus kratia, the power, kratia or power, and demos is the power of the people, power of the people. And some other things from Athens he mentions. The democracy was closely associated with equality, isonomia, and popular assembly, ekklesia, E-K-K-L-E-S-I-A, and a high value of being free, eleutheria. So there's a bit goes on there, and then the Peloponnesian War led to the collapse of the Athenian Empire. After 324 BCE, Athens was incorporated into the Macedonian Empire. Even refers to Athens. Conversely, the downfall of Athens was attributed to the wiles and vainglory of leaders who managed to whip up popular support for ill-conceived adventures. Well, that sure sounds like the U.S. Empire. As the war dragged on, frustration grew, domestic politics bittered, and fractious members of the elite competed to outbid each other by posing ever wilder schemes of conquest. In two attempts, 411 to 410 and 404 to 403, elites abetted by the Spartans succeeded in temporarily abolishing democracy and installing rule by the few. And then he goes on to mention the second case. He gets into some of the history, which is fascinating stuff. Again, hints at the points to the theofascism with the powers of scripture and God and Moses, the founding fathers, these different ways that various authorities have claimed their power. And again, the whole, you know, the native example of democracy is you know, the one thing I would say that's overlooked, and the biggest thing that's overlooked with this book as far as, you know, providing an example or a model of what can be and what is.
And the second example he gives, here it is, an early attempt to give expression to a modern demos with access to political life occurred in the so-called Putney debates during the English Civil Wars of the 1640s. In contrast to the Constitution Writing Convention of 1787 in Philadelphia, where there would be many delegates representative of the modern elites, but none from the demos, at Putney the lower classes and the poor were present and democratic arguments were advanced. Those debates also saw the appearance of a new and self-conscious presence defending the political hegemony of nascent capitalists. And then he goes on to say, underlying these tensions was a further disagreement as to whether the nation was to be tended in the spirit of commonality, equality, and shared power, or governed by those who represented newly emerging interests, mercantile, professional, smaller landowners, intent on challenging the older dominant groups of aristocracy, established church, and wealthy landowners. So interesting there how a sort of middle grade professional class is kind of a step away from the aristocracy and the established church and the landowners, and yet has kind of maintained the level of the you know, control. I think that's what he's saying there. Okay, and then he goes on to highlight how land ownership and land and corporations, again, the whole doctrine of discovery connected with the religious, you know, the anyone not Christian on the land, then it's the Christians can take it over, and that connects to the corporations and the resources. So the whole connection there. And then he writes, dependence is thus institutionalized as inequalities of reward and consequently of power. A future task of intellectual elites is also set to provide the ideology in other, for example, meritocracy freedom, by which inequality would be acceptable and consistent with principles of democracy and equality. So he's, you know, he's pointing to the rigged system and also the ruse that the institutionalized inequality and how it's like the dangling carrot of democracy there, but can it be bit? And the third moment of democracy, the attempt to resurrect the idea of a demos, we might look to 18th century America, not to the contest over the ratification of the Federal Constitution of 1789, nor directly to the Revolution of 1776, but to the political consciousness that emerged among the colonists early in the 18th century and intensified in the agitation of the 1760s against British taxation and trade policies. An American political system would have its origins in protesting imperial policies, only to succumb later to the temptations of empire. So, it's interesting. Very interesting there, I find. He sort of points to, sort of puts a positive spin on where we are now and in how messed up the system is, but the way America has been referred to as the great experiment, well, you know, not so much on the experiment or great part, but it is a window. It is an open, it is a glimpse into the potential. So, you know, in that sense, I see the U.S. or America, however you want to define it, at some level, the positive spin is it is a land that is, you know, has that, at least the topic of democracy is up for discussion, and it has that in the people's consciousness, and it is a land that does embrace people from, you know, various parts of the world, and there is a lot of integration at some levels. Again, it depends on who you are, you know, a minority or coming from a native perspective or oppressed system. Imprisonment of the blacks. So there's all different angles that are sort of contrary, but the point getting across here is that at least there's this opening. And again, he mentions fugitive democracy. If demos were to form, it would have to act from outside and against the system. Consequently, demotic action tended to be informal, improvised, and spontaneous, what can be called fugitive democracy. Demonstrations, protest meetings, petitions, tarring and feathering of royal officials, burning of effigies, destruction of official residencies, and storming jails to free one of their own.
So this is sounds similar to some of the Occupy movement and other stuff that goes on, has gone on and is going on. And again, some of the nice positives, but yet, you know, where's the real change is expressed in this paragraph. Foreign observers were impressed by the intensity of political interest among ordinary Americans during the years from roughly the 1760s to the Constitutional Convention of 1787. An American demos began to establish a foothold and to find institutional expression, if not full realization. State constitutions were amended by provisions that broadened the suffrage, abolished property qualifications for office, and in one case instituted women's suffrage. There were also efforts to ease debtor laws, even to abolish slavery. And then he goes on to say that really the U.S. is really, you know, the storyline is formed from a revolution, but in the way that Thomas Paine was excluded, and here he highlights a quiet counter-revolution. Those attacks on property and the concomitant threat of demotic rule were crucial considerations prompting several outstanding politicians, Madison, Hamilton, and John Adams, to organize a quiet counter-revolution aimed at institutionalizing a counterforce to challenge the prevailing decentralized system of 13 sovereign states in which some state legislatures were controlled by popular forces. A new system of national power was proposed, at once centered yet with authority, coextensive with the boundaries of the nation and designed to discourage demotic power, both by reducing the authority of the states, several of which had enacted legislation favorable to the lower classes, and by minimizing the role of the demos in national institutions. You know, again, the Congress was at one point supposed to, House of Representatives, House being to represent, but that's, he described before how that's been dwindled. So again, that talks into what I mentioned last show, was this sort of dualistic or oxymoronic mindfuck of this mythology of this mythology of democracy, and yet the system is deliberately trying to suppress the democracy. And yet, again, it's the positive spin is that it's in the consciousness, and people are waking up to that and taking more action. So that is a good enough place for summing up, to stop the summing up of the managed democracy as a kind of mechanism or a control freak system to keep the people at bay, to maintain a certain status quo, and to have some input, but yet not really change the system. So it seems like a lot of what is going on nowadays is again, we're seeing the, attempts to, control the people and you know, give something here or there, but to maintain the system. But meanwhile, sort of the wild card is Mother Nature, Mother Earth coming in, and this rise of the native people's movements and natives working with non-natives the Cowboys and Indians Alliance. These kinds of things are happening now to bridge these gaps. So we'll leave it at that for this show. Thanks for listening. Have a good one.
And we'll go out with a little bit longer than usual song, 7-minute song by Leonard Cohen, Democracy.
I'm sentimental, if you know what I mean. I love the country, but I can't stand the scene. And I'm neither left or right. I'm just staying home tonight, getting lost in that hopeless little screen. But I'm stubborn as those garbage bags that time cannot decay. I'm junk, but I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. Democracy is coming to the USA. It's coming through a hole in the air from those nights in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field. This ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens that day. shot, don't pretend to understand at all. It's coming from the silence on the dock of the bay, from the brave of the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy's coming to the USA.
Rafael Bernardo Gaiola on the drums.